Don't you know? You're talking about a revolution. Sounds.
This is the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. With two hosts today, I'm your host, Walt Thiessen, co-host, Bill Westmiller. And we're having a little fun with... I wasn't sure if I was connected or not either. Anyway, it is Thursday, May 1st. We finally made it to May 2014.
May.
And, you know, since we're kind of off to a rocky start, I figure we'll talk about some rather offbeat, rocky stories, starting with the United States Supreme Court. It's hard to believe this, but there's actually a Supreme Court justice who's calling for legalization of marijuana. I mean, I can't believe that.
Yeah, Justice John Paul Stevens, who is no longer on the court, and he had previously said he was interested in general legalization of medical marijuana. And so in this interview, he's very explicit and said, yes, there's very little distinction between marijuana and alcoholic beverages, and it's something that he says, I think in time that will be the general consensus that it's not worth the cost.
Is it kind of, I don't know, a cheap shot? I mean, he left the court, and now he says it. Why didn't he say it when he's on the court?
He's safe. He can express his own opinions instead of just making rulings from the bench. So the various justices do give speeches and that sort of thing, but they're carefully vetted to exclude any opinions about pending issues. So once he gets off the court, then he can write a book.
Uh-huh. So while he's on the court, he can't actually rule on whether or not banning marijuana violates the U.S. Constitution, but once he gets off the court, then he can comment all he wants.
That's the bottom line, but the people who are on the court actually, just a couple of days ago, refused to consider a case that would have called for the legalization of the medical use of marijuana under federal law. In other words, by an 8-0 ruling, the court said, hey, none of our business. We're not going to get involved. We don't care about people who are in pain. We don't care about the constitutionality. And there is a substantive constitutional issue because if you remember way back in your youth when alcohol prohibition started, they actually had to do an amendment to the Constitution in order to ban booze. But nobody ever bothered to make any amendment to the Constitution, because there's nothing in the Constitution that authorizes the federal government to restrict any kind of substances. It just doesn't exist. It's not a power of the federal government. So it's the constitutional issue is, can the FDA do what it does without a constitutional amendment? And the Supreme Court said, no, we don't want to even talk about that issue. We don't even consider that possibility. And so as a consequence, there's really nothing that's pending that would result in marijuana or medical marijuana becoming legal nationwide.
You mentioned that it was back in my youth. I would have to say it was so far back in my youth that I was minus 33 years old, I believe.
But you were an evil thought in your parents' minds.
Yeah, I'm not even sure my parents were around. No, seriously.
I remember way back when.
Let's just leave it that I read history, and I know that history is there. And you're right, that's exactly what the case was. I mean, they actually had to pass an amendment because there were some people who thought that honoring the Constitution was a good idea.
Yeah, well.
Sadly, those people don't exist anymore. But,
Yeah, I think it isn't going to happen in an election year, but I think if a few more states, what we've got, Colorado and Oregon, or a couple of other states that are considering legislation or have initiatives and that sort of thing, I think when it gets to, close to a majority of states legalizing marijuana, then Congress will feel safe enough to go ahead and force the FDA to move marijuana from class one, where it is now, along with heroin and all kinds of nasty drugs that are totally illegal for even thinking about using them, down to a class 5, which at least is, you know, a restriction, but it's requires prescription in order to get those class 5 drugs. So I don't think the politicians have the courage of their convictions or non-conviction to actually change the law until it's obvious that their state is on board with legalizing.
Which, of course, is what qualifies it as congressman, but that's another question entirely.
There's a continuing problem in that these states that legalize medical, even just medical marijuana, although Colorado is almost recreational marijuana. The problem is the states can change their laws and do whatever they want, except the feds can walk in the door anytime they want to and arrest people for engaging in trade in illegal substances.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an amazing incongruity between the federal and the state level, and each can do their own thing.
Well, I hope that your assumption that this is actually going to happen isn't based on the precept that somehow people are going to wise up and start doing the right thing, because if the Donald Sterling situation tells us anything, it tells us that that's not going to happen. And the reason I say that, no, I'm serious. And the reason I say that, I don't condone anything that Sterling said, but I don't know if you saw it. There was an article that appeared in the New York Daily News. Can't remember the gentleman's name. Philip Bondi wrote it. And in this article, he pointed out that some 10 years ago, Sterling was cited in a court case. Not testimony, but his words were cited in a court case. And those words basically showed him to be a complete misogynist, complete anti-women. And nobody said anything.
Yeah.
The NBA didn't get up in arms. The players didn't freak out. The sports writers didn't go nuts. So, you know, he was basically a complete sexist pig. But now that he comes out as a racist, all of a sudden he has to be banned for life.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that he should be banned for life. I'm just saying, shouldn't there be a congruity where we're as anti-sexist as we are anti-racist?
Yeah.
Because,
yeah,
I mean, that sequence of events clearly shows that racism is considered to be immensely more important in this country than sexism.
Let's put this in context, because people may not recognize the name Sterling, like they've been in the incubator for the past.
How could they possibly not know the name Sterling these days? No, go ahead.
Clippers owner Donald Sterling, he was banned for life from the NBA, the National Basketball Association, fined $2.5 million. The NBA basically threw the book at him, saying he not only can't be involved in anything to do with the NBA, but he's banned for life from participating in anything to do with basketball, and he is required to sell his team, his interest in the team, over these racist remarks. Now, it's dubious in my mind whether they can actually do that, and Sterling has said, no, there's no way I'm going to sell it, so it's going to end up in court one way or the other. The interesting case that Sterling has is two different aspects. First, the NBA is essentially a legal monopoly, and there's some doubt whether or not the antitrust laws apply to things like basketball. So he can make a lot of stinking noise about that in a court case. Secondly, the comments that he made, the racial comments, and we're not talking about the sexist comments that you mentioned, but the racist comments were made in a telephone conversation that he had with an ex-girlfriend.
Yeah, that was a private conversation.
It was a private conversation. She recorded it, and it's doubtful whether or not it was legal wherever the communication occurred. It was legal for her to record that.
And kudos to ex-NBA player Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, because that's a point he made in a recent opinion piece, saying, you know, I totally agree, you know, Sterling has to go, he's a terrible human being, should be censured and everything else, but basically he was hung out to dry on the same principles that the NSA operates on, and shouldn't we be concerned about that? That's essentially what his article said, and I agree with him.
Yeah, no, I do too. If the NBA were a legitimate, voluntary, you know, private association of some clubs, not every club, but some clubs, then theoretically they could put in a morality clause and say that you can't say anything in public that brings the organization or the team to disrepute. Now, they can do that, and that may very well be in the NBA code, but notice the word public. It wasn't a public statement. It wasn't like he was on a TV broadcast or, you know, being interviewed or anything like that. He's chatting with apparently somebody he has a friendly relationship with.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he said, you know, stupid, terrible, racist comments, and he's certainly worthy of commendation, you know, morally. But legally or contractually, I just don't see it.
Well, I don't think legally or contractually has anything to do with it. I mean, I agree with you that it should, but I don't think it does. And the reason I don't think it does is because racism in this country as a topic has become so highly charged, not because racism is so heavily prevalent, although there are some people who claim and tell you that it is. I think, you know, the more balanced human beings will tell you racism is down dramatically from, say, 30, 40 years ago. It's down dramatically. It's nowhere near what it used to be as a problem.
Yeah, well, I mean, the problem was always that the state and local municipalities passed all kinds of laws that were explicitly racist and explicitly forbade, you know, blacks from participating in all kinds of things.
Absolutely.
So, you know, that's a bad aspect. Now, can you be a racist and still be civil about it? Yeah, theoretically, you could. I mean, I always consider it ironic and a little bit incongruous that anything that a person of a particular race says about that race is not racist. But if they say it about a different race, then that is racist. And it can even be legally classified as hate speech. For example, I'm white, so if I said, oh, all Caucasians are a bunch of boneheaded, stupid, biased, crazy people, that's a comment about Caucasian race or whatever they want to call it, and that would be considered a racist statement. If I said exactly the same thing about any other race, whether it was blacks or Asians or whatever, I could be prosecuted for the hate crime, just the crime of thinking bad things about another race. Of course,
right.
We're all members of the human race, but you know.
I think you're going where I was going. Basically, I was trying to get to the point that this whole thing has become so completely bent out of, not just out of reason, out of shape, that we've gotten to the point now where it isn't even a question of hate crimes anymore, although that is a bad enough concept as it is, because basically it's saying you should be prosecutable for what you think. And I can think of a lot of times in history where that proved to be a really, really bad idea, perhaps starting with Sir Isaac Newton. Basically the whole idea of race being as highly charged as it is, because if anyone says anything that is even remotely associated with being racist, it's basically grounds for disemboweling him. No, I'm serious. I mean,
yeah.
That's a little bit of an exaggeration, but that's really...
I don't know if they do disemboweling anymore.
Well,
tar and feather, maybe.
but the point is, I think the point is still a valid one. It's gotten to the point now where racism and race is so highly charged that the very goal has been lost sight of. I mean, what was the original goal? The original goal was to stop thinking about people racially, to stop treating them racially. And yet we are now at the point where everyone is being very heavily treated based on their racial viewpoints. So we're actually accomplishing the diametrically opposite goal from what we originally set out to do.
Yeah, we were talking last week about the nature of the Michigan law that the Supreme Court validated. Which says that their schools and public institutions cannot discriminate on the basis of race. And what it was intended to do was to eliminate the affirmative action programs. But it came up to the Supreme Court. The basic question was, how can you have consider a law that bans discrimination being unconstitutionally discriminatory? So there's an irony, a logical contradiction there that applies to social interaction as well. Now, I'm not saying that, you know, that it's, we should let racist comments slide, but we shouldn't let things slide that are totally out of that category. For example, I could very well say every redhead I've ever met was sensitive, you know, hyper unstable, slightly schizophrenic female. And that's a racist comment based entirely on a physical attribute that has nothing to do with the character of the person. Same thing with big noses or anything else. There are all kinds of stupid things that can be said about other human beings that aren't necessarily, you know.
Let's give a little bit of a tip of the hat to why people are so sensitive. People who have a sensitivity about race have a very good reason for it. They have a history that backs up their reason, and it's a history that is shameful. It's a history that is horrible. And it's a history that for many of them, particularly those of our generation or perhaps a little bit older, it was a real part of their lives. I mean, Oprah Winfrey, for instance, picking cotton as a sharecropper because that's what her background was. You know, so to say that racism is the equivalent of, you know, being discriminated against based on the size of your nose, that's really taking it too far in the wrong direction as far as I'm concerned. There are legitimate reasons for being sensitive about race.
But the point I'm trying to make is that race is the color of your skin, maybe a few biological characteristics that are totally superfluous to the character of the person and the fact that they're a human being. They're a member of the human race. They're a member of the Homo sapien species. So anything that's superfluous to their existence and character as a human being is totally irrelevant, whether it's the color of their skin or the color of their hair. That's my point.
I agree with that. I just wanted to be certain that we were, you know, at least exercising some care here, because there is good reason for the history of racism being such a sensitive thing. There's a very good reason for that, and we should never lose sight of it.
Sure. No, I agree.
Now, somebody else who got in trouble for something racially related was former Senator John Kerry, now Ambassador Kerry, because he made a comment about Israel and basically drew a parallel between Israel and South Africa during the apartheid era and got in a lot of trouble for it.
Yeah, I'm not sure that was a nationalist comment or a religious bias comment or what it was.
He said it was
a slip of the tongue. He shouldn't have used that word. But obviously it's a hot issue, and it's not just a hot issue in government. It's a hot issue on a lot of campuses and things where there are groups of Palestinians who are, you know, conducting demonstrations saying that they're being abused and occupied and subject to all kinds of injustices by the state of Israel. And that's created all kinds of ruckus on various campuses. It's probably very frustrating to John Kerry that Israel does pretty much anything it damn well pleases, and if he says anything that in any way supports Palestinian statehood or Palestinian rights or an end to the occupation or settlements or whatever it is, all of a sudden the Israeli lobby is up in arms and ready to lynch him.
Yeah, and I refer to him as ambassador. Obviously, he's Secretary of State. But I think it's an important point, though. There's a similarity here between what I'll call the racism community, the community that gets all bent out of shape about racism, and I don't know what to call it. I guess Judaism is often associated with the race, so maybe that's considered a form of racism, but any comment about the Israelis or Jewish people that is even slightly hinting at being a slight, you know, is again turned into a massive, massive case. And it shows a very high level of what I would call oversensitivity. Now, once again, we have to recognize where it comes from. There is little doubt no doubt I would say that throughout history, the Jewish peoples have been treated abysmally by many cultures, by many countries around the world, particularly in Europe, particularly even here in the United States at times. Fact is that Israel was created to provide a haven to help offset that and to provide a safe place for the Jewish peoples, and all that needs to be recognized. But once again, we have a case where a good idea, an idea of saying, let's stop treating people badly, has been so severely turned on its head that now you can't even refer to them that in any way that's even slightly derogatory, slightly, offensive, slightly, bad, anything that has even a mildly bad connotation. And apartheid, of course, has a very, very bad connotation. But even if you say something very slight, if you say something like, Israel has engaged in certain terroristic type activities, people get up in arms about that.
Hmm.
Despite the fact that it's actually true.
Yeah.
They've done it as a way to fight terrorism. They have fought terrorism by engaging with terroristic type activities. But the moment you say that, all of a sudden, oh my goodness, it's as if we just, accuse, I don't even want to go really far with it because it starts to become actually racist or religionist or sexist or whatever. But, it's amazing how high the level of sensitivity is. And I guess the point I'm trying to make is it isn't a level of sensitivity that seems to be getting better. It seems to be getting worse. It seems to be becoming more and more aggravated over time. And I think that's what we're seeing right now, for instance, with Donald Sterling. I think it's what we're seeing right now with Kerry's comments. I think we're seeing it in a lot of different ways. And at some point, I think it's going to be absolutely necessary for the defenders of those groups, the defenders who are saying, yes, we have to make huge federal cases out of all these things. At some point, they're going to have to say, hey, wait a minute. At what point have we gone too far?
Mm.
Because so far, they don't raise that question. So far, they won't address that one.
Well, I'm not black and I'm not Jewish, but I can get away with a fairly broad degree of criticism of the state of Israel, and maybe even some philosophical criticism of the Jewish religion, because I'm married to a Jew. We happen to be a Cohen, which is the priestly family. I have three daughters who were bat mitzvahed.
Cohen as well.
Yeah, so I have three daughters who are bat mitzvahed, so... nobody can claim that I am anti-Jewish, certainly, and nobody can claim that I am anti-Israel necessarily. But I think Kerry's comment, word, apartheid, is just taking as a totally neutral fact, is true. In Israel, there are all kinds of laws, literally hundreds and hundreds of them, that explicitly discriminate against anyone who is not a Jewish, and in some cases, against anyone who is not a conservative Jew. For example, you can't get married in Israel to a Palestinian. It isn't allowed. You can't get married to someone who is a member of the Muslim faith or even the Christian faith. It's not allowed. It is not legal in the state of Israel. Now, I think that's nonsense. Another law that actually the Israeli parliament changed just a few weeks ago was that they have a conscription program for the military, and everybody has to serve 2 years or whatever it is, except for conservative Jews who are engaged with a synagogue. They don't have to do military service. Now, like I say, they just changed the law, but that's just an example of one and two of hundreds of different laws, particularly in regard to property ownership.
Gaza? Gaza is basically a military camp.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't even call it a city anymore. It's a military camp walled in that basically the Palestinian people are forced to live in under a government they don't control.
Yeah. No, I mean, that is either,
good,
you call it an occupation, where one country is occupying another nation, whether it's Gaza or the West Bank, that's a military occupation. There is no self-government at all. There are no rights. They do allow a vote for a leader of the Palestinian Authority, but that's about the extreme of it. And in a lot of cases, they explicitly protect with military force all these settlements, some very far-flung into the West Bank that have no relationship to Israel's existing borders at all. So anyway, there's a lot of different aspects, but my point is that I don't think apartheid is a necessarily false accusation against Israel. It may also be true in Palestine. It may be true in 100 other countries too. But in the flip reverse effect. I don't know why it isn't possible to discuss those kind of things.
I think I can answer that. I mean, perhaps possible is the wrong word, but I think I can answer why it's not something people want to discuss. And one of the best reasons I can get is that apartheid as a word has a very, very, very negative connotation to it. So the moment that you throw it into a conversation, you're basically engaging in very negative conversation. And that's pretty close to ad hominem right there. That's pretty close to personal attack, if it isn't a personal attack.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so
that's exactly where the problem is.
Yeah, but, you know, to some degree, and I haven't looked at the South African laws recently, but to some degree, it was okay to use the word apartheid as long as the whites were oppressing the blacks. But when the blacks took over the government and they started oppressing the whites, which happened, and a lot of properties were confiscated, a lot of people were isolated from the community, a lot of people were jailed for having participated in the previous administration, not causing any harm to blacks, and there was apartheid, but you couldn't use that word, because this was blacks discriminating against whites.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. And it doesn't mean that the word shouldn't have been used, but it shows just how sensitive that word is. It had become such a negative word that they felt that it was in their best interest to essentially ban the word.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's a good idea. I'm just saying that's what happened.
Yeah. Well, this all comes down, at least in the United States, ignoring foreign policy issues and things like that, to the issue of hate crimes.
And
the FBI director came out the other day and said it was a consequence of some of these events that have happened recently. We need to push states and counties and municipalities to start tracking hate crimes. We need to develop a database of hate crimes or suggestions of hate crimes so that they can track them so that the feds can prosecute them under the hate crime laws.
And here's the real problem. I mean, well, we've touched on a few aspects of the real problem, but here's where I see the biggest problem where the concept of hate crimes is. The biggest, besides the philosophical and the epistemological and all the misuse of the English language and all that kind of stuff, just the idea of prosecuting hate crimes falls into the same category of a war on terror or a war on drugs or a war on poverty. And the people who push for a war on hate crimes fail to recognize the parallels. The reason these parallels are so important is that every time we declare war on something, it gets worse. And there's actually no exception to that rule. That has always been the case. And there's every reason to believe that a problem of what people think, whether or not people are hateful in their thought, is going to increase. Well, I can tell you right now, folks, the more we turn it into a crime, the more we prosecute it as a crime, I guarantee it's going to become worse. It's not going to get better.
Because that's the
way it works. When the government tries to declare war on something, it always makes the problem worse.
Yeah, well, it's an Orwellian kind of thing. The use of the word war gets thrown around so much and has for the past century that, war on poverty and things like war on women and war on this and war on that. It just carries the whole concept of war as a violent confrontation between two different parties to the worst extremes.
Yeah, it really does. Well, let's see. We've used up half our time talking about some very sensitive topics. Let's talk about some less sensitive ones after the break, such as monetary policy and surveillance. Oh, no, I guess those are pretty sensitive, too. Maybe not on the same scale. But anyway, this is the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, here on the Progressive Radio Network, and we will be right back.
And finally, the tables are starting to turn. Talking about a river.
We're back here on Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, Walton Bill on this Thursday evening, and monetary policy and economics. Interesting development happening over in Asia because it looks like if what the World Bank's figures tell us are actually true, the United States may no longer very soon have the number one economy in the world.
Number two. We are number two. Yay, us.
I'm trying to make a serious point here.
No, I mean, it makes perfect sense. I mean, the population of China is like, was it 5 or 10 times larger than the United States? And, you know, in spite of their communist political structure, they've gone through various cultural reforms that have basically freed up the market, and people are engaging in, you know, businesses and a certain amount of economic freedom for exporting, importing, trade, and so on and so forth. So at some point, somewhere, someone, wouldn't be surprising for China to be, you know, a major economic power. And actually, they've been, you know, a major power among the top five or six for almost a century. Well, maybe not a century, maybe 5 decades since the Cultural Revolution. But, go ahead.
I was just going to say, and actually, I believe the population is about 4 times ours. They got about 1.3 billion people, and we have 310 million, so it's about, you know, a little over 4 times. But the thing that strikes me about this is that, yes, they have like 4 times the population of what we have, and they're just now starting to exceed us in terms of overall economic output. But, and there's a big but here, there's no Chinese middle class. Or put it this way, the Chinese middle class is so small as to be negligible. So I wonder how significant this event really is.
Well, yeah, I mean, like any communist country, if you look at Russia, for example, it's an oligarchy, and the people that run the government also own and control the major industries, and they're the ones that are making most of the money. There's no doubt about that. However, I think there has been, and I haven't looked at any demographic numbers for a distribution of income, but they've pretty much loosened up all of the regulations they used to have on accumulation of wealth. And so it wouldn't surprise me if you know, the middle class was you know, increasing in size to some degree. And mostly people coming out of the lower classes who were always in a state of poverty for centuries, if not millennia, who are now moving up the economic ladder in terms of starting up their own businesses or providing services to their neighborhoods and communities and actually improving their lot.
Well, there's been a lot written about China's middle class, especially over the last 2 years, but when you read, and specifically about how it's booming, how it's expanding like crazy, but when you read the details more closely, it makes you wonder about the definitions. And the reason I say that is, let me take a look at one here. I just picked one up at random in a Google search. Found an article at CNN.com from June 2012, so basically a little, almost 2 years ago, right? Mm-hmm. And in this article, the article is called China's Middle Class Boom. The article has a little graph in it, and in that graph, it is citing the growth of middle class 1980, 1990, 2000, and 2010, and what the disposable income was. Well, disposable income per capita was $280.
Okay.
1990, $316. 2000, $760. And then 2010, $3,000. So annual income of $3,000. And in fact, when they dig a little bit more deeply, they find that the typical family of three earns around $9,000 a year.
Yeah.
Now,
no, it's true.
This doesn't even come close to what Americans would consider to be a middle class.
Well,
so,
no, I mean,
I have to raise the question, is this legitimately a middle class?
Yeah, in dollar terms, it isn't anything comparable to the United States, but you have to take it in context. And I think if you compared, for example, the percentage of the population that was, you know, in quintiles, was at the bottom of the economic ladder. I think that the number of people in each quintile would have increased above the lower classes. That's no doubt that the top quintile or the top 1% in China is so much more massive and so much more money in their hands and so much more political power, which I guess is it has to be the nature of a communist political system, where you all your friends get the benefits of any government intervention, and it's very similar in Russia too.
But if let's say we look at comparable cost of living, okay? And there's a site I like to go to for this, numbeo.com. I don't know if you've ever seen it. And numbeo.com. And they do a lot of comparisons on cost of living around the world. If you use their site to do a comparison of the cost of living in the United States with that of China, pretty much, you know, they check things like consumer prices, rent, restaurant prices, grocery prices. They have a whole bunch of things that they check. And, you know, all the numbers vary somewhat, but when you kind of average it all out, U.S. prices are about 50% higher than Chinese prices. So that means if you're trying to compare cost of living and relative incomes, a $9,000 income in China basically buys them the equivalent of a $13,000 U.S. income, or maybe 13.5. Well, that's still considered poverty level. So basically what we're saying is that China's middle class is impoverished. And I think that's an accurate evaluation of what's going on in China. So if China's middle class is impoverished, and chances are their upper middle class is also impoverished, is it really meaningful to describe a middle class, regardless of quintiles? I mean, the fact of the matter is, as big as the gap is between rich and poor in this country, it is overwhelmingly larger in China. So that a very, very tiny percentage of the population literally controls the overwhelming majority of all resources everywhere and enjoys the only real prosperity.
Yeah, I know.
So how can we describe that group that is in terms of quintiles in the middle as a middle class when they don't really live like a middle class?
Well, first of all, cost of living is you know, totally different in the U.S. versus someplace else. I mean, every house has 3 TVs and 2 cars. I mean, that's the cost of living in the U.S. It just isn't the same. But
yeah,
I think you have to put it in.
3 TVs and 2 cars does not account for the difference in income. I'm sorry.
No. But what I'm saying is putting it in historic context, for example, comparing it with 2 decades ago or 4 decades ago, the change has been relatively substantial. The improvement has been relatively large.
Yeah, instead of being ground down into absolutely mind-breaking poverty, now they're in tolerable poverty.
That's
the difference is.
No, I agree. There's no doubt about it. And, of course, the upper class and the large corporations that are usually state-owned by politicians are making all the money. So the GDP for China is, as you say, 90% of it is in the top 1% of the population, those who are members of the Communist Party. And communism was supposed to be for the benefit of all the people.
Oh, yeah, right.
The matter is that communism is, you know, control of the entire economy by the party. And they've loosened those controls to some degree, and so I think there's been a historic change that has to improve a whole lot more than what it is right now.
Well, it has to improve a whole lot more in order to be considered a real change, I think. And this all goes right back to what the headline is. The headline is China is becoming the number one economy. And my counterclaim is that doesn't amount to anything. Until the middle class actually becomes like a real middle class and the working class becomes like a real working class, it doesn't make any difference. It's a meaningless event.
Well, I don't know. The only thing I could say is that if the gross GDP, if the total amount of financial transactions that go on in a country, you know, is increasing, there are going to be more people involved, particularly if the political environment is such that they're encouraging more economic innovation, more entrepreneurship. They're giving their citizens freedom to trade and manufacture and sell products that they couldn't do before. Before they were basically all slaves.
They're still slaves now. They're just paid a little bit better.
Well-paid slaves.
No, they're not well-paid. No, they're just paid a little bit better.
Okay. No, I agree.
And hang on to this concept for a second, because our next article actually ties in an indirect way. The next article we have, it comes from Forbes magazine, and it's a suggestion that the housing situation could foretell a market slump. The headline said, "Is housing ringing the stock market's bell again?" Why don't you fill people in on that one, and I'll draw the tie to the Chinese situation.
Well, people remember back, of course, to 2007, 2008, when the big disaster hit, and we had the threat of the too big to fail companies failing. It was because of housing. It was because the housing market totally collapsed, and the price of housing went down. So the most obvious tops for real estate bubbles, there was one in 1989, which led to a recession in 1990 and 91. And, of course, the housing bubble of 2006 burst in 2007, and we got dumped into the Great Recession and the bear market. So this week's reports itemized that existing home sales were down another 0.2% in March, continuing a downtrend that began last summer. So things are extremely soft. Most discouraging, new home sales plunged 14% in March. Now, this is not existing homes, this is new homes, to a pace of 384,000, which is far below what anyone was predicting. So it's been a real disaster, and they don't really go, this Forbes doesn't go into any specific details about what might be causing this slump in the housing and what effect it might have on the stock market. But we've discussed numerous times the effect the Fed has had by creating new dollars that they are investing in Fannie and Freddie, who are the primary mortgage processors.
That's right. That's so the bubble in the first place.
So with that stimulation being faded out slowly, the amount of government financial support for unrealistic housing prices is fading away. And that's definitely going to have an impact on housing and, as a consequence, the general economy altogether.
And it's still up in the air what the housing market's going to do, because there are signals in both directions. It's going to go up, it's going to go down. There are definite indicators in both directions. So just because Forbes says we're going into a market slump that's going to adversely affect housing doesn't mean that's necessarily the final word, but it's certainly one of the possibilities at this point. However, the reason I mentioned that this is very much in context with the China article is that China has, for quite some time now, forced people who wanted to invest whatever money they had earned in the real estate market. That was the only kind of investment people could make. Mm. And as a result, as we've talked about here on the show before, there are entire ghost cities in China, huge cities that have nobody living in them, simply because the Chinese people were forced to dramatically overinvest, far beyond anything that ever happened here in the United States. So if there was a housing slump in that country, and that it was being foretold by a market slump in that country, talk about taking a country back to the Stone Age. You could forget about China becoming the number one economy. That would just basically wipe that portent right off the board. So I would say the risk is actually greater in China than it is in the U.S. I agree there's a risk here in the United States where the housing market is concerned, but I would say it's much bigger in China, and it shows just how ridiculous it is to talk about a Chinese middle class.
Well, you know, we can talk about the libertarian perception of almost any kind of government planning and government manipulation and control of the market is totally fruitless, if not absolutely destructive.
Which is the real fruit. The real fruit is poison.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's true. And in China, the Chinese government isn't, I mean, they're, I guess I could call them malicious, the political class, but they're not stupid. They're out for their own benefit, and they can see things that are really stupid.
Yeah, they're very intelligent parasites.
Yeah, there you go.
They are.
I mean, they can see that these ghost cities were just a totally ridiculous proposition, and something in their, you know, controlling mechanism, their five-year plans and so on, and restrictions on their citizens, resulted in these kind of insane projects. And so I think...
But ultimately, they didn't care about that. They didn't care that they were insane.
Well,
because they got paid by the government to do it. Or they, yeah. they got the citizens' money and squandered it on ridiculous construction that had no demand. So it's a consequence of the communist system. The communist system doesn't believe in a consumer price, balance.
Correct.
That supply and demand balance out and consumers make the decisions about what is worth what it's worth.
That's right.
They have no choice. They have no choice in the matter. So when the communist government decides that, they need more construction, they, pass a law or whatever they do in China. And they say that's the only thing you can invest in is construction and commercial.
And the other point to be brought out is because of that, it doesn't really matter whether these things make money. It doesn't really matter whether the towns were built fruitlessly, because all that really matters is that the powers that be, the people who are in power, the few who are prospering at the expense of literally the billions, those people are beginning to maintain their power and to exercise their power, and that's all that really counts.
Yeah,
so if there's a market crash later on, they don't care. It doesn't matter to them. What matters to them is can they hold on to their power, can they continue to exercise it? And there's no reason to believe that they won't be able to.
No, that's true. There's an interesting parallel that very few commentators I've noticed have glommed onto, and that is Egypt. And Egypt is a particularly, it's not communist, it's not, obviously anti-democratic since the overthrow of Mubarak or whoever it was.
And before that.
But what's happened in Egypt is that the U.S. has been giving the military billions of dollars, I think it's $3 or $4 billion every year for decades. And that money goes to the military, and there are no controls. So the military takes that money and they buy up private businesses. So right now in Egypt, it's almost the same as in China. 90% of the private business is owned by the military. And it isn't, explicitly communist. It's explicitly militarist. It's a totally military-dominated economy. So a lot of the things that are going on in Egypt, and there are other countries that are similar, is entirely a consequence of a dictatorship.
It's amazing how often we see this pattern playing out around the world today. I mean, it's very difficult these days to point to any country where the economy is truly free market, where consumers really are the kings, where basically the economy exists for the people, and certainly where there are actual civil liberties in place. I mean, you can't even point to the United States anymore, and that used to be the shining beacon. So this has become the norm. This has become the way this is business as usual all around the world. And we're pointing out the more egregious examples of it, but really it's everywhere.
Yeah, and one example for the United States is in space launch capabilities.
Yeah,
there's another one. SpaceX just filed a lawsuit against the federal government saying that they should be able to compete for launching spy satellites. And my friend Boeing, who I rap on every now and then, got into a deal with Lockheed Martin, and they created this expendable launch vehicle, which is the monopoly. The Air Force and NASA cannot contract with anybody except this group, run by Boeing and Lockheed, in terms of launching. So they get all the contracts there. They're not put up for public bid. This ULA it probably gets $3 or $4 billion a year in contracts from the Air Force for their launch vehicles. Now, it isn't just spy satellites. It's any other kind of government satellites. There is some private launch facilities, of course, that are open for bidding, communication satellites and things of that sort. But it was interesting to me that Boeing and Lockheed have just totally locked up all the government expenditures in terms of launching spy satellites.
Yep, and that's a small example, a relatively small example compared to the others we've been talking about. Yeah, a perfect example of how it has little to do with what's good for the people. It only has to do with what's good for those who are in power. Kind of sad, but true.
Well,
speaking of being in power, we got about 5 or 6 minutes left. We haven't really touched lately on the NSA, and you know how much I love to touch on the NSA. So I thought we should probably touch on the NSA a little bit. And the question has arisen about cell phones, and are they, first of all, is the NSA scoping them out? I think we're pretty sure that they are.
Yeah.
But more importantly, are cell phones protected in any way, constitutionally, under civil law? Are they protected at all? And this question was actually raised in an article. Let's see, I can't remember where the article is from. Where is it from, Bill?
Well, it was a Reason magazine summary of
Reason. Okay, is that what it was?
This particular issue, but this particular issue didn't have to do with the NSA. It had to do with the local police grabbing cell phones in the course of, you know, they arrest you for drunk driving or whatever it is. They take your cell phone and they start paging through it and see who you talk to and what you were talking about. And here's a marijuana buy. You know, here's this, here's that, and end up with another dozen charges against you as a consequence of looking through the cell phone. So one of the victims of this kind of thing brought a suit, and it's now gone to the Supreme Court to decide whether or not police have the authority to search a cell phone or even a computer that they seize in the course of an arrest for some other crime. So it's not directly NSA, it's police forces and how they're using the products of the search.
And that's correct. But the reason I mentioned NSA is the NSA loves to take advantage of any chink it can find in the law anywhere and use it to their advantage to the fullest, taking it to the umpteenth mile in order to do so. So I thought this was a significant case, if only because if it had gone the other way, it would have opened a massive hole for the NSA to basically go in and tap everyone's cell phone with impunity simply because they're able to do so through the authority granted to the police. Fortunately, the Supreme Court backed off on it a little bit. So while our cell phones aren't truly safe, there's at least a mild barrier in place there. But this could have been a big thing for the NSA.
Yeah, well, they just did oral arguments, so you have to guess where the justices are coming down. But, for example, Justice Lena Kagan, during the argument, this is Riley versus California, quote, people carry their entire lives on cell phones. Now, that suggests that they might be disposed, not just in this particular case of a search, but when the NSA cases start hitting the courts, they're going to have a disposition about collecting metadata. Hopefully, they will.
Possibly. Kagan is generally portrayed and believed to be a left-leaning justice. So the real question is going to be, what do the so-called centrist justices think about?
Well, it's interesting. It hasn't been on the spying and surveillance cases. It isn't always conservative versus liberal on the court. There have been cases recently to do with various aspects of the Fourth Amendment where two conservative justices and three liberal justices made up a 5-vote majority. And the conservatives, you know, made their argument in a separate brief, but it isn't always split along conservative-liberal lines as it is on a lot of the other issues.
Well, that's why I mentioned that I was contrasting her to the centrists, not to the conservatives, because the centrists have the largest plurality on the board, as you pointed out, on the court. So if either of the left or the right chooses to go, if just one of those justices chooses to go with the centrists, they have a majority. So that's what I'm saying. It's really what the centrists think that's going to really govern this thing.
Well, the case itself points out an interesting thing, and there hasn't been an actual case that's made it through the court system yet, but there's something that's been going on for a long time that is almost a conspiracy, in a sense, between NSA and military and police departments. And what it is a fake cell tower.
Mm.
It's a service that's sold by a private company that only deals with, you know, government agents. And what they do is they buy this device, and I don't recall what the name of it is, but it acts as though it's a cell tower. And therefore, whenever you make a phone call in the vicinity, a cell phone call in the vicinity of these towers, they get not just the metadata, but they're able to actually record and all of the communications that go on in that area. it's got, you know, whatever the range is, 40 miles, 50 miles, something like that, they can actually, local police use this device to track individual cell numbers and actually listen to conversations. Now, in several court cases that have come up, they've denied, or rather refused, to state that they had this technology, much less that they were using it. So it's an interesting cross blend between what the NSA is doing and what the local police are doing.
I think the conclusion here is, folks, it isn't just your email that's being searched. And Bill, I guess we have to draw a line there because once again we've used up an entire hour. Can you believe it?
Can we take another hour?
I wish we could, but we'll have to wait until next week. So we'll ask you all to join us next week here on the Freedom News Hour Surviving Meltdown. Goodbye, everybody.
Don't you know we're talking about a revolution sounds? Don't you know we're talking about a revolution sounds? They're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around waiting for a promotion. Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds. Who are people gonna rise up, get their share?